Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. Little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. And on today's show, we're going to have another one of our favorite roundtable discussions, which I've been really love having the last year. We've got three former champions who have all been on the show before. Mr. Tom Terwilliger, who was a professional bodybuilder in the 1980s. And we also have Mr. Tony Pearson, who was the 1978 AAU Mr. America winner. And Tony was also a very top pro bodybuilder in the IFBB during the 1980s particularly. And then we've got Phil Williams, 1985 NPC National Overall Champion. And Phil also won the 1988 Chicago Pro Champion. So we got all three of the guys together again, and we talked a lot about just all aspects of what they went through as bodybuilders in the 1980s, including what it was like to turn professional and what their early training was like. And this episode, we've got two episodes. We've got part one and part two. So in part one today, we're going to hear a lot from Tony Pearson, where he talks about an upcoming documentary that they're making about his autobiography, which was called Driven. And if you haven't read that book, I really recommend you go out and get it. It is available on Amazon. Tony went through a lot as a child, really abuse, really raised by his family. And it was just an incredible upbringing, not a good one, but he overcame it and he moved to California at a young age. I think he was still a teenager and remarkably won the Mr. America at 21 years old in 1978. And then spent his whole career as a pro bodybuilder. And now he is doing Las Vegas and he looks amazing in his 60s. He actually just competed last year. So first part of the show today, we're going to hear a lot from Tony about this documentary and about his life and a lot of what is written in the book, Driven. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right, so we got a lot of news going on. We missed the show last week because I've just been busy. I've been doing some online coaching for a company called Pro Physique. So if you guys are interested in hiring my services, go to prophysique.com and you can sign up and ask for me as a coach. So I've been really busy on that, trying to build up my clientele. And that's why we did not have a show last week, because I could not find anybody to interview. But we're back this week and next week. And we should also have Janet Tech, who was a top bodybuilder in the 1980s. And I'm supposed to interview Janet this week. So hopefully her interview will be coming up after part one and part two of our interview with Tony and Tom and Phil. So I've been trying to build up some of those interviews for the women's bodybuilding section. We had we started a season about a year ago for women bodybuilders, but I couldn't get anybody except for Corey Everson, of course, one of the greatest women bodybuilders ever. But Janet Tech is going to join us. I'm going to interview her this week, so that interview will be up in a couple of weeks. And when we get done with our interview today, I'm going to read an article. This is from the February 1979 issue of Muscle Builder magazine, and it's going to tie in with our interview. It's called, the title of the article is called The Unhappiest Mr. America, and this was about when Tony won the Mr. America contest and the repercussions he suffered from it. and it's written by Rick Wayne. So you guys are going to enjoy that. So I will read that right after we get finished with our interview today. All right. So yeah, a lot's been going on in the bodybuilding world. There's been a lot of deaths in bodybuilding, some from older bodybuilders, but a lot from competitors who are competing now. There was a female bodybuilder who died a couple of weeks ago. She died, I believe, the day after her contest. And then there was another Italian bodybuilder who died. And I believe a lot of this is from diuretic use. It was so affecting to Jake Wood, who is the owner of the Mr. Olympia. I guess he knew that woman bodybuilder who died, that he actually had a meeting with Jim Mannion and Tyler Mannion. And they talked about somehow changing the judging standards so they wouldn't be judging conditioning so much, because that's what he believes is causing these people to die from diuretic abuse, because people are trying to get so conditioned that they're using diuretics. So they kind of agreed to not judge conditioning as much, but I don't know how that's going to work at all. So we'll see what happens the remaining contests this year. I think maybe they should try to get maybe some more testing done for diuretics or something like that, or maybe bring out some. I was listening to one podcast and they made a good point. They said they should just bring out more information on this, so people know what they're doing and they don't make these stupid decisions. I guess a lot of the coaches are telling their competitors or their clients to take all these diuretics, and that's what's causing these deaths, because diuretics can kill you immediately if you lose all those electrolytes and your heart stops. So that's what's going on in bodybuilding. It's kind of weird right now that just we're having all these deaths in a row. And speaking of that, Phil Herndon, who won the 1995 MPC USA, a huge bodybuilder if you ever saw him. Phil was one of the thickest bodybuilders ever and never really had much of a pro career, but he did win that 1995 MPC USA in grand fashion. And I remember he beat Craig Titus at the time, and Craig thought he was going to win. He thought it was his turn, and he got very upset and he tore his medal off and threw it on the stage. And I think they suspended him for the rest of the year for doing that, the bad boy of bodybuilding, Craig Titus. But yeah, Phil Herndon passed away just a couple days ago, and I don't know what the cause of death was, but I know he's been suffering from kidney failure for, I think, the last 3 years at least, because I've seen him on Facebook a lot, and he's not afraid to talk about it. So Phil passed away, probably something related to that, or maybe it was heart-related. I don't know. I guess we'll find out in time. One of the biggest stories of the last couple of weeks is Arnold Schwarzenegger kind of put his foot in his mouth. He did an interview for some podcast, and he was talking about the pandemic, and he was talking about how it's important to be vaccinated and it's important to wear your mask and wash your hands and do all the things that prevent us from COVID virus from getting out and spreading any further. And then Arnold, at one point in the interview, said people are complaining about wearing masks, saying, you know, this is America. We should be free to choose what we want to do. And Arnold, in a very loud voice, said, screw your freedom. And boy, did that create some controversy. Everybody has taken offense to this, particularly in the bodybuilding world. Aaron Singerman, who owns Redcon One, which is a huge supplement company, one of the biggest supplement companies in the world. And Aaron has always been a huge supporter of the Arnold Classic competition. They've given hundreds of thousands of dollars to that contest over the years. He came out with a video and he said he will no longer support Arnold Schwarzenegger or the Arnold Classic. And he is pulling all his money and all his sponsorship from the Arnold Classic for the time being. I don't know how long this is going to be. That was the biggest one. That made national headlines. That was on Fox News and CNN. And other people now are also saying the same thing about Arnold. Callum Van Moger, who actually played Arnold in that movie Bigger, which was Dan Solomon's movie that he helped get produced and get released. And that was, of course, the story of Joe Weider. And Callum Van Moger played Arnold, and very convincingly. I thought he was one of the best things in the whole movie. He has always been a huge fan of Arnold, and there's videos and pictures of Arnold actually showing Callum how to pose in the gym at Gold's Gym and stuff. And so Callum said he no longer supports Arnold. Who else? Oh, Brian Shaw, who won the World's Strongest Man contest at the Arnold Classic, where they have the strongman contest. He's won that several times. He was on stage being interviewed by Arnold many times. He made a video of he's taking his poster of Arnold down from his gym. So this is just running rampant. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens next month when they have the Arnold Classic in Columbus, Ohio. And that's kind of weird, too, because of this pandemic, they did not have the Arnold Classic in March. Of course, the Arnold Classic, as most of you know, I'm sure, is the biggest event, really, in bodybuilding. It's bigger than the Olympia as far as the expo goes. They usually have 600 or 700 booths at the Fitness Expo. It's one of the biggest fitness expos in North America, probably is the biggest. And they have sports from all over the world. In fact, they have more sports than the Olympics has. And this is all in one weekend in Columbus, Ohio. So this year they did not have that. I think last year was messed up also because of the COVID. This year they pushed it all the way back to September, and they are only having the Arnold Classic. I don't know what pro shows they're having. I know, of course, they're having the Men's Open. I don't know what other ones they're having. I think it's limited. They are not having an expo, and it's really messed up. So we'll see what happens. I know they got a good lineup, so I don't know what kind of crowd they're going to get. I just heard a rumor over the weekend that they may not have an audience like they did last year. So I don't know what's going to happen. And now all these people are pulling away from Arnold. This is unprecedented. I mean, Arnold was always the king of bodybuilding. He was the Muhammad Ali of the bodybuilding world. And he's been a hero of mine and a hero of many people. I mean, he's inspired millions and millions of people. And now it seems like he's just gone too far with this screw your freedom comment. He said he's going to write about it in his newsletter, which will probably come out this week. He did not make a video or make any kind of statement about it. So we'll see what happens. But this is an ongoing story. What else? Oh, I'm following my diet finally, guys. I'm going to try and get in shape for October when I go to the Mr. Olympia. I think I'm supposed to be doing backstage interviews again. Sean Ray's going to bring me on board. So I'm really excited about that. I did that last year, and I'm supposed to be doing it this year. So I want to look my best. So I figured I'll use that as an excuse to get in shape. I haven't been in shape in 3 years because I had those two hernia surgeries over the last couple of years. Feels good. I'm getting leaner. I'm following my diet. I'm not eating the cookies. I'm not eating the Quest bars. I've been kind of semi-dieting, since the beginning of the year, probably since March at least. And I've just been staying the same. I haven't changed at all. But this, you know, I finally decided, okay, that's it. I'm putting away the cookies, putting away the Quest bars, and it's making a difference. I've already lost like half an inch off my waist in the last couple of weeks. And I can see my abs. They're much harder. A lot more vascular now, so I've probably got another inch and a half to go off my waist, and I should be in great shape in time for that Olympia. So it feels good to get ripped again and get in shape, so keep you guys posted on that. All right, we got quite a few emails, so if you guys want to email me, as always, you can go to naturalolympia@gmail.com and send me an email, and I will read it on the air if you want me to. But I haven't read any for a couple of weeks, so I got a couple here. John D. Hartman wrote me an email a couple weeks ago, and he said, "Hey, John, I hope you'll be mentioning the passing of John Meadows on your show. I know he never achieved legendary status on a bodybuilding stage, but he certainly did as a coach and a mentor to so many. I found John's YouTube channel at a time when I was struggling with nagging injuries. His mountain dog style of training helped me get healed up and has taught me things I didn't pick up on my own, and I didn't hear from others, from workout structure, reps, form, etc. His videos make you feel like you're working out with him, and that lends to feeling like you know him, kind of like how we all feel like we know you, John. This loss has hit me hard, and I've seen from others on YouTube and Facebook that I'm not alone. Rest in peace, Mountain Dog. John D. Hartman." Yes, I did mention it on the show, of course, and it's amazing how many people were affected by the loss of John Meadows. And as I said, I didn't know John that well, but I did know him when I saw him at shows and stuff. I always said hi to him. But he really did affect a lot of people, and I hope they keep his YouTube channel up because I always enjoyed seeing his videos too. I always picked up workout tips from him. He was really, really a great trainer, and he just had that way about him where he was just very genuine, one of the few genuine people in the sport, because there are a lot of assholes in the bodybuilding world, let's be honest, a lot of people who are just out for themselves and big egos, and John was not like that at all, so he will definitely be missed, and he left us way, way too early. So it's really a shame. And I feel bad for all the people that were really close to him, all the people he worked with. I know on Fuad Abiad's show, he actually didn't even do a show for like a week or two. And he does multiple shows per week because he was so close to John. And you could tell it's still affecting him. He just mentioned on one of his podcasts last week, the last one he did, that when he's training, he can hear John's voice in his ear, which I thought was very touching. So, yeah, rest in peace, John Meadows. We are definitely going to miss you in the bodybuilding world, and we needed people like that. All right, this one says, "Hi, John, I've just finished listening to part 3 of your 4-year anniversary podcast. You should be so proud of what you've achieved over the last 4 years. interviewing the legends of bodybuilding so they can share their stories with us, the fans. Your interview style is so natural, allowing your guests to feel relaxed and speak freely. You are passionate about bodybuilding and bodybuilding history, and this shines through in your podcast. The group style interviews you've done more recently are a welcome addition, allowing previous guests to return to discuss and debate different topics, unearthing previously untold stories along the way. The three-way dynamic of these shows often has me in hysterics. Perhaps an idea for a future podcast would be to discuss a fantasy Mr. Olympia between the champions of the golden era. For multiple winners, you could pick them at their best condition, such as Arnold from 1974, Zane from 1979, Haney from 1991. This in itself could lead to subjective debate. Whilst we might not email regularly, I'm sure I speak for all your listeners when I say we love the show and we truly appreciate all the hard work you put into it. Kind regards, Martin. All right. Thank you, Martin. That was very nice of you to say that. That does sound like a good idea for a future show. We are always welcome to new ideas for future shows because we're always running out of topics. So that sounds like a good one. All right. This next email comes from Scott Barron, who's been one of the biggest supporters of the show. He's been, I think he was my first Patreon donor. So Scott has been really a great fan and supporter of the show. And he sent me an email and he said, "Hey, John, I hope things are going well. On August 25th, I'll be undergoing open heart surgery to replace a failing congenital bicuspid aortic valve with a mechanical valve. I have an excellent medical team, excellent insurance, and over 100 accumulated sick days saved up throughout the years working for the Chicago Public Schools on top of my three-month family medical leave. I've had 11 years to prepare for this, and I won't lose a dime. It would lift my spirits tremendously if you could possibly give me a shout-out to me personally and perhaps a couple of days or so prior to my procedure. I've written an article about my condition some time ago on the Arnold Fans website, and I spoke about it at length in Muscular Development's Ronline Report via YouTube. The irony, of course, is that it's the same procedure that Arnold had back in 1997 and again some 20 years later regarding my full 2 days with Arnold way back in 1992. Thanks. I was born with an aortic heart valve that has a bicuspid leaflet. Most have a tricuspid. In 2010, I was going to learn that I have a lot more in common with Arnold than just a two-day-long visit. So what Scott's talking about is back in the 1990s, in 1992 or 91, at the Arnold Classic, they were giving out a drawing for all the VIP ticket holders, and you could spend 2 days with Arnold, hanging out with him on the movie set, going to the gym with him, eating lunch with him, and Scott won the contest. So in 92, I think? Yeah, it was when they were filming The Last Action Hero, so that must have been probably the beginning of 92. And they flew Scott out to California, and he got to hang out with Arnold on the movie set. I think he also met Clint Eastwood that day, because Clint Eastwood was hanging around the set. And he got to see them filming Last Action Hero, and then he got to work out with Arnold at World's Gym. And I think they went out to lunch at Arnold's restaurant, Shotzi's on Main. So he wrote an article about it for Muscle Mag International, and they published it. It was several pages. And he said he also was on the Ronline Report with Ron Harris back on Muscular Development on YouTube. And he also wrote for it at the Arnold Fans website. So, yeah, it's kind of ironic that Scott has to go through the same procedure that Arnold had, but it sounds like he's ready for it. So, Scott, we wish you the best of luck. And like I said, you're a great supporter of the show, so we will be supporting you. And that'll be coming up this week, Wednesday the 25th. So we'll be thinking of you, Scott. I hope everything goes good. All right. This next email says, "Hey, John, I just wanted to drop you a note congratulating you on the 4-year anniversary of your show. I'm looking forward to year 5. I enjoyed listening recently to the 2-part interview with Mark Martinez concerning his upcoming bodybuilding documentary. I've known Mark for a few years from the Iron History forums, and I remember when he announced that he was doing this film. Good to see it's come to light after a handful of years. Thanks for putting out great shows. Your efforts are very much appreciated by us old school bodybuilding fans. Dave Hartnett from Salem, New Hampshire." And this last one is from Spencer Tyndall. "Dear John, I feel the need to email you to tell you what a truly fantastic podcast this is. Your interview techniques are brilliant as you listen to the guest, and you always revisit any questions that are unanswered if the interview goes off topic. Also, the interviews can be hilarious at times, and I find myself laughing out loud at certain guests. Jerry Branham and Phil Williams spring to mind. I can listen to a full show of you reading articles from the old magazines. It takes me back to my youth and a magic era. Great job on a truly brilliant podcast. I competed when I was younger and I won a few shows. I've enclosed a photo of myself from 1992. I always relied heavily on condition. I was around 5'7", 160 pounds, and I had a tiny 24.5-inch waist. Wow. I've never heard of anybody having a 24.5-inch waist. That's crazy. Excuse the caked on tan. Please keep trying to get Rick Wayne on the show, who was, in my opinion, the best writer ever. Kind regards, Spencer Tyndall. All right. Thank you, Spencer. And Spencer did send me a picture, and he did look fantastic, especially for 160 pounds. You would never think he was only 160 pounds. That waist is crazy, though. I think the smallest waist I ever heard of was 27 on Sergio, of course, and Steve Mihalik, but I never heard of a 24.5-inch waist. Wow. Congratulations for achieving that great physique. And thank you for the email, too, Spencer. That was very nice. And I love Jerry and Phil also. I love having them on the shows. Those guys are hilarious. Sometimes I'll go back and listen to some of those old shows just to get a laugh myself. And we did get also another email from the Apple Podcast. If you listen to our show on Apple Podcasts, you can go to Apple Podcasts and under our show on iTunes, you can leave a review. This one says, I love this show. I love listening to John and his different guests each week, some who I know of and some I'm still learning about. Very motivating for me when I don't feel like I can fulfill my own personal goals. I love to have it on at work when I can. Thanks. Tim, via Apple Podcasts from Ireland. So thank you, Tim, for listening all the way from Ireland. I appreciate that. All right. So thank you guys for emailing me. I love getting your emails. So please, if you have any thoughts on the show at all, any suggestions, any advice, whatever you want to talk about, or any questions, if you have any questions for me, please email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I will read it on the air, as I said. All right, so that's all I got for our opening. Here is our interview with Tom Terwilliger, Tony Pearson, and Phil Williams, part one. Here we go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and I have three very special guests with me today. Going around the bend here, we got Mr. Phil Williams, who was the 1985 MPC Nationals champion and also the 1988 Chicago Pro champion. And then we got Tony Pearson, who was the 1978 AAU Mr. America winner, and he also went on to win the NABBA Mr. Universe and Mr. World. And finally, we got Tom Terwilliger, who was the 1986 NPC Nationals Light Heavyweight Champion, spent many years as a pro, and won the Niagara Falls Pro Show. So welcome to the show, guys. Good to have you guys back on the show.
It's good to be on, John.
Great. What thank you.
Very good.
Awesome. Yeah.
All right, Tony, let's start with you. I saw something about that book you did called Driven, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
They're making a documentary about that. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's my life story. You know, I was raised in the Deep South and in the 60s and the civil rights and all that stuff. So it's not really about bodybuilding. Of course, it's a part of the book, but it's really about a troubled life and how to survive it and not get caught up in drugs and crime. And I mean, I could be dead. So it's a survival story. And the reviews are pretty good. And the documentary, we went down to Memphis, Tennessee, and I had to go back and retrack everything I did growing up as a child. Imagine that. We went to all of those spots, very emotional ride. And I think it turned out really well. The producer seemed pretty happy with what I had to do. You know,
how did you get that going, Tony? How did you get a documentary going?
Well, what happened was Eric the Trainer, you know Eric the Trainer.
Yeah,
from Hollywood, a good friend of mine. He comes over, he works out with me in Vegas. Eric Tang comes over, he wants to train with me. And then he goes to my massage guys. He's got his routine down. So one day he brought this guy who lives in Vegas, Steve. He said, hey, this is my friend Steve. And we started talking, I started training Steve. And then we realized that he knew somebody very special, Joita's daughter.
Mm.
And she owns a Tequila Markenberg production company in L.A. Hmm. She read my book a couple of times, and she said, we got to do this. We need to do this one. And she jumped on it really, really seriously, and I was like, whoa, okay. I'm excited. That's how it began. It just word of mouth. I mean, Steve knew her, and she contacted me and it was on, you know, she goes, it's a great story for a lot of people, even adults who are dealing with childhood issues that they never resolved.
Right.
Or kids who are in trouble today, which is a lot of kids, you know, the suicide rate is the highest it ever been in this country for kids because they're lost and they're alone. They're lonely. They have no direction. They have no support. Single parents, you know, in a household, or they're being abused, or just a lot of things. And she said, this is a great story to reach out and help people in general. And you survived. She could not, she said, I can't figure out how you survived, but you did. And that was the meaning of, that's why we did the book. So we went to Memphis and we interviewed my family. and then we went on to St. Louis, my high school, my old high school. We go back there and where I grew up, the house there. And we went to George Turner. You know George Turner, right? Somebody.
Yeah.
We actually went to his gravesite and we filmed there. And I was actually talking to George, you know, because he helped so many people. He was a bad guy, tough guy, crazy guy, but he, deep down, he really tried to help people. And I was like, I was one of those lucky kids. You know, the first day of this gym, he came over and says, hey, I'm going to train you. I think I was 18 years old. And from that point on, you know, he trained me every day for about 9 months and just tried to kill me. And then, you know, I decided to go to California. So we went to George's graveside. We went to my old high school, the old house I grew up in. Just a lot of stuff that I had to actually relive. And it's weird going back to that. We're talking 45, 50 years of stuff.
Jeez.
That you kind of pushed away, you know, you forget about it. It's all tucked away, but it's really not. You know, we carry all this trauma around with us every single day.
Mm-hmm.
We put on a nice face. Everybody has a great face.
Mm-hmm.
Deep down, there's issues. And so this book kind of helped me a lot to heal.
You know,
on the good days, writing the bad stuff, there was a lot of tears.
Mm-hmm.
And the fun days, like I won a title, that's a lot of fun to write about, you know, or I get to travel somewhere around the world. That was fun. But it was funny how emotionally you just, it all comes back. And I went to Memphis, a lot of stuff came back that I totally forgot about because I'm standing in the spot where it happened.
Mm.
Yeah. So this is Memphis, St. Louis. And then we finished in LA when my first apartment I had in LA. We went there. We went down to Muscle Beach, of course. We went to both Ghost Gym, the one in Santa Monica and Second Street and Broadway, Santa Monica, and then the original Ghost Gym, and then, you know, Ghost Gym as it is today. So we went all three places, and then down on the beach, Venice Beach, just to kind of sum it up to coming from where I came from. You know, down in the South in the 60s, it was tough.
Yeah.
As a child. I was childhood. Civil rights was going on. I was in the middle of it. But I was living in a nightmare in my own house.
Yeah, I know.
There was no escape anywhere. So
yeah, it was unbelievable. That book was unbelievable when I read it. Did you guys read it, Tom and Phil?
Appreciate it.
Absolutely, yeah.
You were driven.
For sure.
I appreciate it, yes.
Yeah, you were driven, man.
But you know, I just want to tell kids out there, you know, you can survive. You know, it's a mindset.
Yeah.
You watch all these crime stories and the guy says, well, I killed 20 people because I was beat up as a child. No, you made a decision to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You decide what you want to do. You don't have to be like that. Like my dad was crazy. And I said to myself, I'll never be like my dad.
Mm. Yeah.
I made that decision. It's not passed down.
It's
you blame somebody else. It's never your fault.
Mm-hmm.
But it is your fault. You did it. You have to
blame
it. You have to own it.
Right.
So I just, you know, I was fortunate to have George in my life because he became like a father to me. I didn't have a father. I didn't have a mother. I had no one. And I was tortured. So George was like a father. You know, I was terrified of him. But, you know, it helped me a lot. And he conditioned me. He said, you're going to California. It's going to be rough out there. And I look back and I go, George is right. He got me ready for the fight, for the battle.
Yeah.
And so it's a story, and I try to take you back. I actually try to put you in Venice, how it was in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
All the afros and the music and the energy. The bodybuilding was so new at the time that people just couldn't get enough of it. I mean, they would sit around that weight pit down in Venice and just watch for hours. Just watch us work out, you know.
Yeah.
They're coming from all over the world. Sweden, Germany, you know, all these places just to see the bodybuilders in person. Wow. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's crazy. I just did an interview with Mark Martinez, and he's got that documentary coming out. And he goes back to the 70s, and that's how it was. It was like bodybuilding was so fascinating because it was like so new for everybody. And nobody now, of course, muscles are accepted. Everybody works out. It's a totally different thing. But back then it was really unique and really, really fascinating for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. But the only place that was like that was Venice, California.
Because
I'm from St. Louis, and they thought I was a freak of the year. You know, he's out every day. He wants to build his muscles. What's wrong with this guy? You need to get a job. So the situation in St. Louis was not great, but I kept hearing about California, and I kept seeing the magazine. I saw the pictures. I was watching Arnold on ABC White World of Sports when he won Miss Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 years in a row, I was watching this stuff. Go, oh man, I got to go to California. And I think part of that too was in kind of an escape too. I was running from the book, if you know what I mean. I was escaping part of that too. I realized you can't escape it, because I got to California, and that first year I would wake up cold sweat every other day, thinking I was being tortured again.
Hmm.
2,000 miles away, she still had a hold on me.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so that's how deep. It's really deep. But somehow, like I said, I survived. And then, you know, Robbie kind of helped me out. But in those days, you got to prove yourself. These guys were serious. I remember I went to the Gold's Gym for the first time, Pacific Avenue. I just arrived. I got about, you know, $10 in my pocket. I walked into Gold's. I sat in the corner. I watched these guys train. Joe Weider was training. He was taking photos of Frank Zane that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then Robbie, Manuel Perry, Danny Padilla, Kenny Waller, you name it. They were all there. And I was just sitting there going, oh, my God. Like a 19-year-old, eyes as big. Oh, my God. But then I said to myself, if I train hard enough, I think I could be like those guys. You know what I mean? I don't know. Something inside of me just kept saying, it's going to be a lot of work. But I believe that I could. Then I got distracted. You know, I was starving, trying to figure out where I'm going to sleep, when I'm going to eat, and all this stuff. And then Arnold comes over, and about 3 months in, he comes over and he goes, I've been watching you for months working out here. On Muscle Beach is 100 degrees. I'm squatting 400 pounds, 10 sets of 10. That's all I knew. Whatever George taught me, that I was continuing to do it. 10 sets of 10, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with a training partner. And I didn't know Arnold was watching. And he says, you know, you got a great potential. You're going to be the champion. I could use his voice. And then he says, you know, he sent me to see Joe Weider for the first time. But so that's what was a turnaround for me to say, see, this is what kids need. They need somebody, maybe just one person that can inspire them, to lead them down a good path. You know, not the game banging and all this crazy stuff, drugs and alcohol, but somebody's doing something positive.
Yeah.
And once I got to LA, that was Arnold. How did I get into bodybuilding? I met Muhammad Ali in 1973, walking down the street in St. Louis. And this limousine pulls up in front of a high school. And I said, oh, you got to be the president of the United States, the police escort, everything. So I ran as fast as I could to get to this car. I got to see who gets out. Muhammad Ali gets out. So 1973, he's the current champion. Dressed in his blue suit like a superhero god. His muscles was this big. And I'm looking up at the champ. So, oh, my God. So that was the first time I thought about fitness, you know. I wish every day I'd lived for 12 years, am I going to die today? That was in my head.
Wow, no kidding.
And starving. I didn't get any food. So, but Ali sent me in the right direction. I said, okay, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm too slow. I'm too small. But I was strong. I couldn't run. I couldn't play football. Forget it. Boxing, please. But I was very strong. My friend says, man, go to the wrestling team. Go out for the wrestling team. You are very strong. And I did. So I make the team. So that's out. But all you need is one person that is going to inspire you.
Did you talk to Ali on that day?
I did. Yes. And I met him again a few years later after I had just won in America. And I had the book in my hand.
So oh, really?
The book. Yes, yes. Hmm. He wasn't the guy that I thought you were ever going to see on TV. Because he's always in the mic and he's yelling. He's super quiet.
Huh, really?
very reserved guy. You know, he talked very softly and he was very nice and he loved people. He had an entourage with him. Everybody stopped, him and Veronica, his wife Veronica. Everything stopped. He stopped in front of me, signed my book, and talked to me. And I was like, whoa, with an entourage standing behind him. So that's, he loved the fans. He was a people's champion, that's for sure. So
What did he say to you when you were a kid, Tony?
He asked me, when I was a kid, I said, can I shake your hand? He goes, yeah. And then I said, the mistake that I made, he went into the high school and I should have followed him in.
Yeah.
I mean, he don't sit and talk to the kids for an hour. That's what he did, you know?
Oh, okay.
So he didn't say very much. He just smiled and shook my hand and I walked to the door and that was about it. But like I said, a few years later, I actually got to meet him, which we were at a party on the Queen Mary in Long Beach because, you know, he was in the Olympics. He won the gold medal.
Yeah.
And Wilma Rudolph was a track star also. She won gold medal. So they were good friends. He was having a party for her. Houston McTeer was the fastest man in the world, Olympic champion, 1976. Houston McTeer, he's passed on. I was good friends with him from Santa Monica College. And he goes, hey, man, you want to go to an apartment on the Queen Mary with Ali? I go, yeah. But twice in my life, I get to meet Muhammad Ali. So
yeah,
that was a thrill. But like I said, this is what kids need today, someone to inspire them, to motivate them. And you got to really choose your friends very carefully, you know, because your influence, especially with social media, we didn't have any of that. So, but still, you got to make sure you hang around good people. And I was lucky to be around the gym. I was a young kid with all the champions. You know, all these guys are 10 years older than I am. So I was a young kid hanging around. But like I said, you got to prove yourself to them. So I had to win a few titles first before they would say, hey, you want to work out? You want to go hang out? Yeah. So it was like a little group, about 15, 20 guys that really kind of started bodybuilding.
Yeah.
Because in the mid 70s, it was still like taboo. You do what, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. There was no real exposure on television. You wait for the magazine every 6 weeks to come out. You pray to God that you're in it.
Right.
You don't have a picture and you're a nobody. So that was the only publicity you're going to get. So it's, I don't know, looking back, I don't know. You know, leaving St. Louis, it was something I felt I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
But going back just now, reconfirm I did the right thing.
Yeah.
I always questioned it. I left my sister. You read the book and she was upset. But I went back to St. Louis. I went back to Memphis and I go, I did the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's the right move I could have ever made. But it's terrifying when you're going out to a place 2,000 miles away from home, you don't know anyone, and you're broke.
Yeah, they took a lot of balls for you to do that, especially at that young of an age.
And you're a kid and had no experience in life.
You didn't know anybody out there or anything.
No one. But what I'm saying, I was sheltered. I didn't have any friends growing up. I wasn't allowed to have a friend.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I wasn't taught anything. I didn't have a dad. I didn't have a mom. So I was very naive when I arrived in L.A. Very. Yeah. I didn't talk much. I just kept my mouth shut because I didn't know what to say. I'd win a show. I didn't smile.
Like, yeah.
There's a video of me. I just, Wayne Gulash just put it on Instagram that when I won Mr. Venice Beach, there's an actual video of it. We have it.
Oh, really?
Wow. Never seen it before and just recently. And I had my head down the whole time. I went, they raised my hand. I walked off the stage. The camera still followed me. I had my head down. I went to back into the weight pit. I said, my head was down the whole time.
Hmm.
So I never looked up. That's what I was taught to do as a child.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was 19, but I'm still a child. So it was a tough road. And the documentary is, I think, pretty much done. I think it should be out the end of September.
Oh, really? Okay.
October, very good. Yes.
Where will it be released?
I don't know. Teresa is, you know, Joe Weider's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to get it on Netflix or Amazon or, you know,
okay.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's about an hour and a half long. It's about 2 hours long now.
Yeah.
It has to be cut down to about an hour and a half.
Right.
There is a lot of twists and turns in this one.
Yeah.
Believe me, I went back to a cotton field and I actually taped in a cotton field. You read in the book.
Wow.
So to be standing in the cotton field in Memphis, Tennessee at my age going, I'm a child again.
Yeah, yeah.
Psychologically. And I got deadly ill after that. You know, flying from St. Louis back to Vegas, I was really, really sick. Like my nerves, my whole system pretty much shut down.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, it really, really took a toll on me. For 3 weeks, I didn't think I was going to make it.
Wow, no shit. Damn.
Yeah. I've never been so sick in my life. And I think that had a lot to do with it.
Just from all the stress of going back?
Yeah, it all came back.
Yeah, wow.
When you read about it, it's kind of like a story to read. But when you're actually there,
yeah,
this happened. Yeah. So.
Wow. Well, I can't wait to see it. I'm glad you, that's amazing you got that done. Cause I know I remember when you were talking about doing the book, you know,
right.
Now you did the book and it touched a lot of people. It affected a lot of people. And now it's just by chance, by circumstance, you know, and now there's a documentary. So that's awesome.
Right. Yeah. I feel blessed to have that. And I mean, what are the chances of meeting Eric the Trainer, which I met in Muscle Beach? He's a wonderful guy. This is the most nicest guy I've ever met in my life.
Yeah.
Helping everybody. He's always in a good mood. And right. Then his friend Steve, who lives here in Vegas, and he goes, hey, he knows Joe Weider's daughter. I go, and she has a production company. And she read, like I said, she read the book a couple of times. She said, I had to read this again.
Mm-hmm.
And because it just takes you, it's not, like I said, it's not about bodybuilding. People go, oh, it's a bodybuilding. No, it's not. It's about life.
Yeah.
Hard life. And I think most people have had a tough life growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And some,
yeah, you know what I mean? A lot of people relate to it. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's a blessing, you know, and somehow I survived. And I look back now, well, how did I survive that? I'd never had a plan. I didn't plan anything. I'm just
right.
When I went to LA, I didn't have a plan. Just get on the bus and go.
Yeah.
I said to my friend, "We'll figure that out when we get there."
Yeah.
That's what kids do, you know.
Right.
We have no fear. The only time he had fear when he packed his bag and went back to St. Louis because he couldn't take it.
Right. I remember that.
After 10 days, he's gone. Then the fear came.
Yeah, he's not by
himself. I went straight to the hospital because I was having a heart attack.
Wow, really?
Yes, the nurse said you're physically healthy.
Wow.
What's going on in your life? And I told her, and she said, yeah, you're hyperventilating, you know, you'll be fine. But yeah, I was like, that's when the fear hit, when you got $9 left in your pocket and your friend just left you. And I had no idea what Muscle Beach was. I'm downtown LA in the ghetto. You know, it's tough down there.
Mm-hmm.
And after 10 days, I jumped on the bus with my $9, and I said, I'm going to go wherever this bus takes me. That's where I'm going to go. So in downtown LA, you got 1,000 buses. You can go to Pasadena, to the Valley, you name it, in Woodland Hills, anywhere.
Right.
I got on the right bus. I got on the bus that was going to go from downtown to Beverly Hills. And that was the last Rodale Drive and Santa Monica Boulevard. Last stop, he said. I get off. Looking around, and I saw Richard Burton. You know who Richard Burton is?
No.
The actor, Richard Burton.
Oh, Richard Burton, yeah. The one who married
Elizabeth Taylor. Elizabeth Taylor, right.
Right.
I saw him walking from the mansions.
No way.
across Santa Monica Boulevard going to the shops.
The stores.
And I went, Richard Burton. I'm in Beverly Hills, what I said to myself. I was clueless. We didn't have a TV, so I didn't know anything about Hollywood or any of that stuff.
Hmm.
There was a kid sitting on the bench, big afro, 70s man. He was cool. He was a typical LA guy. Young guy. What's up, my brother? You know how we talk in the 70s. And he goes, you are pretty buffed. You need to go down to Muscle Beach. That's where all the guys work out, man. And I go, yeah, that's where I need to go. So he's giving me the address. He said, this is where you just take this bus, get off at 2nd Street, Santa Monica. And that's how I made it to Venice.
Wow.
But this one kid sitting at a bus stop, and there was chaos because of the traffic in Beverly Hills. Come on. But everything went quiet.
When
he started to speak to me. It was silence. I didn't hear any noise. It was just a voice speaking to me.
Yeah.
So I go, it's a divine intervention here somewhere. I mean, what are the chances of getting on the right bus, the kid at the bus stop, and then get to Venice? and get to witness the real pros at the time, 1976. Mm-hmm. I think it just before the Olympia. It was getting ready for them because these guys were really training. I wrote in the book how there was no one's talking.
Yeah.
No one's drinking water. I mean, they were just very, very intense. You could feel the energy. It was a small gym. It was a compact gym. And the guy behind the desk, I think it was Dan Howard.
Mm-hmm.
He was a manager at the time. And after 30 minutes or so, go, what the hell are you sitting in the corner? Get over here. So I'm nervous and shaking. Oh, boy. And I, you know, I asked him if I could work out for the day. No. Is Arnold here? No. Is Kenny Waller? And I looked over and I saw Ken Waller. Because George told me to go talk to Ken Waller. Maybe he can help you.
Right. Because he went to George Turner's gym.
Right. He trained there as well.
Yeah.
But he looked so massive and so thick and so mean. And I said, no way. I'm going to go near that. I didn't go near him. He was like, he was sitting on a little stool and his shoulder was this wide.
Yeah.
You know how thick Ken Waller was?
Yeah, he was huge back in the day.
He was huge. But he was very intimidating. I didn't go near him. But I somehow survived through that, and they threw me out of the gym. That's right. He goes, you don't have any money. You can't buy a membership. You have to leave. We can't have you hanging around the gym, he said. I took my little suitcase, and there I was. And then I went down to Muscle Beach, and the crowd was crazy. The boardwalk was crazy. You know, recently I just went to Venice, and it's so sad now. You know,
I know. That's what I heard.
All the homeless people, and it's never going to be the same again.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a really fun time and atmosphere. You had dancers, you had rollerblading, the roller skating thing going on.
Music
blasting, people, comedians down there, people in costumes. It was just like that I saw on television back in St. Louis. Oh, my God. And to be a part of that. And then you went down to the Muscle Beach and it was packed. The weight room was full of people, guys working out, very serious about their training.
Yeah.
And all the fans are just like, eyes just big, staring back and forth at these guys. Oh my God, look at all this. It was like a different world.
Yeah.
I had been in another world because in St. Louis, there was nothing going on. Nothing going on. It's amazing. So, That's how it all happened.
Yeah. It's sad when we talk about those old days of bodybuilding. That's all I do on this podcast. But it seems like it is gone. You know, like those magical days are gone. It's just everything's different. I mean, you know, time changes, things move on. And
right.
Like you said, Phil, you thought it was going to be like that forever. And
yeah, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not.
No.
It's changed.
Yeah.
No, bodybuilding was new and it was... You know, I think people thought it was obtainable after a while.
Yeah, yeah.
The guys were big, but not so big.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in the class of physique they have today, but they don't realize back in those days, we had a lot of muscle on our frames.
Uh-huh.
You know, small bone structure, small waist, small hips, but a lot of meat packed on.
Yeah.
The shape and the definition, and you know what I mean? So... Even when I saw those guys training that day and their arms looked like they were 22-inch. Everyone had a 22-inch arm. I said, oh, my God. and a stone face. But I still said to myself, I think I could someday.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It did seem more attainable. And I think that's what motivated so many of us when we were young and we started off and reading the magazines.
Yes.
All those guys did look unbelievable. You did have that feeling like, if I work hard enough, I can do this too. I can look like that.
Yes, and exactly what I said to myself. And watching on TV, the first time I saw bodybuilding on television, I was impressed with muscles, but I was impressed with the art form.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm more of an artist.
Yeah.
Way, because this guest poser from St. Louis, he came out and he had a spotlight. And from pose to spot, we go dark, spotlight, spot. You know what I mean? And the spotlight. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there going, oh my God, this is art.
Yeah, yeah.
Sculpting their own bodies.
Yeah.
Watching Arnold and Robbie and Muhammad Mikawi and Danny Padilla and White Wall of Sports. And look at the structure of their bodies. Look at the muscles.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about it. But instinctively, I said, this is art. And I want to be an artist. I'm going to sculpt myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, you want a big arm. You want a big chest and all this stuff. But that was not – I never wanted to be big.
Yeah, it was more than that.
Big enough to win. That's all I said.
Yeah.
I think, you know, some people's bodies are made for the stage and some people's bodies are made for the gym.
Yeah, that's true. There's gym bodies and stage bodies, right? I know.
The great bodies at the gym. You put them on stage, you go, what happened to the guy?
Right.
because nothing's in balance. Nothing flows. Legs too short, long torso, wide waist, this, and this.
Yeah.
And then the other guy, you look at the gym, it looks like nothing. That would be me. Over in the corner, you know, sweating and grinding it out. And then on the stage to go, where did that come from?
Yeah, exactly.
I used to have people run backstage and go, was that you out there? I look so small. So, you know, it depends on your structure and your balance of proportion.
Yeah, yeah.
And your hips and your waist.
Absolutely.
And how well you present it.
Yeah, I like what you said about the art form. Tom, you had that similar experience, right, when you saw Corny Clothes at that Pumping Iron premiere in 1977.
Can you hear me okay? I'm not even sure my mic is working. Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah, it's
working. You do it. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I totally resonate with what Tony is saying. In fact, it was a very similar experience for me back in New York because it was the 70s and I began as well. I won my first teenage show in 78. And I was sort of stumbling into a gym that was the equivalent of Gold's Gym in Long Island, New York. In fact, it was the predominant bodybuilding gym. Tony Pandolfo, Steve Mihalik, Mr. America trained there. Joe Nazario, who went on to turn pro. And all these other guys. I mean, everybody in this gym was serious, man. And I walked in there as a 15 or 16-year-old kid at the time. Just started lifting, watching these guys, looking at these guys in the magazines. Exactly what you were talking about, those black and white photos in Muscle Builder magazine and Iron Man magazine from Artie Zeller, who was photographing all those guys you were talking about, Padilla and Arnold and Franco, you know. And so I that was my first experience with that. And then walking into that gym, you know, and I think I've shared, maybe you had the same experience. It must have been like that at Gold's because it was such a small environment. And so was this gym, Future Man Gym in Long Island, couldn't have been more than, I don't know, 2,500 square feet. Wasn't big.
Right.
Packed with equipment. Guys in there, and the first thing you experience when you walk through the door as a novice, as a kid, is the aroma. Because remember, Tony, remember Phil? I mean, everybody back then was there, like Ben Gay. Ben Gay.
Yeah.
And then there was the vomit, of course, and the sweat. And nobody washed their clothes. I mean, like the sweat, it was like everybody wore gray. In California, it was a little different. It was a lot of shorts and T-shirts and tank tops. In New York, everybody just wore gray champion sweatsuits, you know, sweatshirts that were just like brown stained everywhere. You know? But to go back to your point, John, was my first experience ever seeing a bodybuilding. It wasn't even a bodybuilding competition. It was actually the opening of Pumping Iron.
Mm-hmm.
In Manhattan. I'm trying to remember the year. It must have been, what was that?
77,
yeah.
Yeah.
And Ed Corny guest posed, Lou Ferrigno guest posed. There was a couple others. I can't quite remember who it was. Maybe Robbie.
Yeah.
But when I watched Ed Corny pose, it brought that to life. It was like, I knew I wanted that muscle. I know I was already compelled. This is what I wanted to do. But that was the convincer, man. Tony, like you said, when you get to see that it's more than just – even more than just an athletic endeavor, it is an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And it was truly that art form that had compelled me for all those years. And one of the reasons why I always ultimately wanted to be just a great poser and display that art form, you know, just as you did, Phil. And Tony, you were a master poser.
Yeah.
Never forget your routines as well. You know, that lat spread, good God. Yeah, but very similar experiences, and I'm betting Phil has something of a similar nature as well. We all, and going back to one other point, which is, you know, we all have those experiences, that trauma early in our lives, in some respect. And bodybuilding for me, and obviously for you, in many respects, Tony, was that it was a saving grace. It was something to focus on. It was somewhere to channel that energy, that negativity, right, and put it into something productive. Yes. And along the way, I think what happens to so many young bodybuilders, well, maybe not as much today, but certainly then, is if you were serious and you dedicated a little time and energy and people could see, like in the gyms at Gold's or in Future Man, could see you were serious. You weren't just some kid that came in and wanted to get a view.
Prove yourself. Right? Yeah.
Yeah, you were proof. And then someone, for me, it was Tony Pandolfo, who was later on the Masters, Mr. America, won several titles in New York. kind of took me under his wing. He said, "Hey, you're pretty serious. You're down here. Let me teach you some stuff." Mm-hmm. And believed in the potential. When someone believes in your potential, and let's face it, we all have potential for one thing or another. Right. If someone believes in it, someone sees it and illustrates that interest in you, it can change the cards, man. The whole deck changes in many respects, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Amazing. Absolutely. Yeah.
Phil, who's the first guy you saw on stage or in the gym that, you know, you got that art form or that, you know, the bodybuilder that really inspired you?
The first guy was a guy named Dave Washington. I was with his son. His son said, "My dad's a bodybuilder." And I've been bullied for years. I mean, from 6 years old on up, on a daily basis, I used to pay 50 cents a day for protection fees. Right? So I wouldn't get beat up. So I never got to eat lunch. And I told my mom once, and she went up to the school and complained, and it got worse. Right? Because they found out that she complained, and they complained to the kids, and the kids took it out on me. So I didn't do anything. So I never talked about it after that. And another funny thing is, not too people know this, my dad was a professional boxer in the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. He fought on the same card with Sugar Ray Robinson. Oh. And so he had a good career, and he wanted to teach me how to box. And we'd go in the backyard, and we'd put on gloves, and he'd show me. But there were always two or three or four kids when they would get you. They'd get you in a corner. What are you going to do? And I was afraid to use it. So I talked to this kid, Dave. I said, "Who's your dad?" He said, "My dad's a bodybuilder." I said, "What does a bodybuilder do?" He goes, "Oh, I'll show you pictures." So he brought pictures of his father. I said, "You got to introduce me to him." I said, "When does he pick you up?" And I waited around for his dad to pick him up. And he introduced us. And I bugged this man for 6 months to take me to the downtown YMCA. That was the only gym in Kansas City during that time. There were no gyms back then. Mm-hmm. Finally, after 6 months, he goes, "Ah, Philip," he said, "you still bugging me?" He said, "Man, all right, man, meet me down there on Saturday." So I met him down there on a Saturday. He showed me the basic exercises. And from there, I started going Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And after a year, he looked at me and said, "I can't believe you're still here." He goes, you think you're serious, don't you?" I said, yeah, I'm serious, David." He goes, "All right." He goes, I said, "I want to hear, I saw magazines." He gave me a bunch of magazines, old Ironmans, old Muscle Builders, and Muscle Training Illustrated magazines that were from the 70s and further back. The Ironmans went all the way back to the early 60s.
Yeah.
I discovered and found out who everybody was, read as much as I could. And then from there, I found out there was a teenage Mr. America. So I wanted to be teenage Mr. America when I was 17. The first show I went to, he finally got me, helped me get ready for a show. David did. And I did the Mr. Missouri Valley. It was a novice show in 77 in Kansas City. It was at the YMCA under a basketball hoop. You had the light.
Oh, yeah.
Remember?
Oh, yeah. The light, the hanging light.
And I went out there with some Kmart posing trunks. Didn't shave, didn't know anything, didn't have any hair anyway, not much of it. And of course, I took 13th out of like 26 guys. About 2 months later, he goes, "I'm going to St. Louis." He was training for the Mr. Missouri over 40. So he took me out there, and I competed in the Mr. Missouri and took second in the short class at 17 years old, which was a big deal. And that's where I met Samir the first time and Danny Padilla, and I was introduced to George. And George, I talked to George, of course, and George, "Hey, kid, if you want to work out," he goes, "this is the place you want to be." So I told you this story before. I used to drive Friday evening from Kansas City to St. Louis. That's like just short of 400 miles. It's 365 from border to border. And I'd sleep in my car Friday night, train Saturday evening, sleep in my car, get up Sunday morning, work out, drive 400 miles plus back to Kansas City to go to school on Monday morning. Oh. And my mother and my parents were great. My mother was liberal. She said, "Okay, just give me a call when you get there. Would you do that?" I said, "Yeah, Mom, I'll call you." And that's how it started for me.
You were 17, Phil?
17 years old.
Yeah.
So it went from David, who was introduced me to George. And then from there, I started driving out to Turner's Gym from Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And then from there, George offered me a job. He found out I was sleeping in my car. That's where I got the name The Enigma. He goes, that kid's crazy. He goes, "What's wrong with him?" And I did this in the snow. You drive down, the 405 in Kansas City, if I'm not mistaken. That was a long drive in the snow, man. And then you sleep in the car with blankets.
In the winter.
But yeah, just to be a bodybuilder.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted it that bad. And from there, it only increased. That desire only increased from there.
Yeah.
Look at physiques back then. I mean, it was a different era altogether, of course. But they did look obtainable. But there was beauty along with symmetry, proportion, balance, deep separation.
Yeah.
Intricate detail, which is something you don't see much of today.
Right.
I respect the size these guys have, but they're so big. I never dreamt of becoming that big.
Yeah.
I trained to look like Samir and Robbie and maybe a few other guys I admired. And that, if I'd obtained that, that was basically obtainable in my mind. And that was my goal right there, to look like those guys.
You know, what's crazy hearing all these stories from you guys is, you know, this is back in the 70s and we didn't have all the, you know, all the advantages they have today, you know, the phones and all the gyms. You know, like you said, there was hardly any gyms around back then. You had to travel so far to get to a gym. And then when you got there, you weren't accepted. Nobody said, oh yeah, come on in, kid. You know, nobody helped you. You had to prove yourself. So it's just amazing the desire you guys had to prove yourself when there was so much going against you compared to how it is today, where we can, you know, kids today can watch anything on YouTube. They can see all these things. We never even got to see these guys that we admired. We only saw them in the magazines. We never saw them in person, you know, unless we went to the Mr. Olympia or went to Gold's Gym. So it's just amazing all the things we had against us, and we still wanted it so bad. We were able to do anything.
I think I was too naive to understand I don't know if to say it was dangerous to do that.
Yeah.
To me, that was just, okay, I'll do it.
It was crazy to do it.
I was happy to do all that.
Right.
It told me what to eat. It's funny because in high school, I would take cans of tuna and an apple, or hard-boiled eggs and an apple. I would have 36 eggs a day, 6 times 6, 36, 6 meals a day. And if it wasn't eggs, it was tuna.
Right.
And hard-boiled eggs. I did that for years.
I added the same thing. I added some peanut butter in there just for a little some variety. Yeah. Even hard-boiled eggs with peanut butter on it. You know what I mean? It's just like, I need calories. Got to get some calories. But it is interesting. I think, you know, John, to your point, which is it's a little easier. It's a lot easier today to, in marketing, we call it an open loop, right? An open loop is I'm going to suggest, hey, here's something you're going to learn. Here's something you want to know about. Here's something that's going to pique your interest. And you know what? We'll go back to that. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. It's an open loop. Then I come back and close the loop. And for us, early days was the interest peaked, but we couldn't close the loop easily. So it heightened the curiosity. It heightened the desire a little bit. And we were willing to do whatever we could to find out what's on the other side of that loop. What's on the other side of these images? What's on the other side of that contest? Is this for me? Is this something I can explore and be part of? And it really drove us. And in fact, I think driving that many miles, riding my bicycle to Future Man Gym, which was, you know, 20 miles away in the middle of winter, it created that it's like, hey, if you could do this, man, then you've got what it takes maybe to be a champion somewhere along the way. But when it's too easy, it's
desire isn't there.
Yeah. I think we all know guys that had like the super genetics. There were guys, I knew guys certainly when I was training.
Yeah.
That, like Tony said, I didn't look like much in the gym. Never really looked like much in the gym.
Yeah.
And there were guys that were like, oh my God, freaking guy, it's genetics. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But maybe it was too easy for them.
And they didn't have the desire. Yeah.
Yeah. And could never really overcome the obstacles that they needed to overcome in order to be able to really exploit what they had.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of
important. Some guys, like I said, some guys are. Bodies are designed for stage.
Stage physique.
And I think Craig Zane is one of those guys too. You know, you only look good under that proper light. If the light's right, you're on point.
Yeah.
And your presentation is on point. You give the illusion of something that's not even
real.
That illusion.
But that's structure though. That's the waist, the hips, the bone structure. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Of course you gotta have enough size to pull it off. But your condition's gotta be really, really on point.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tony, I think you were really a prime example of that in many respects, because you were never that big, you know what I mean? But when you got on stage, the waist, the tiny hips, the little joint structures, I mean, how much did you? I never knew how much you would weigh, like at your peak condition. What were you?
I think at the 80, Wind America's 185. I think on stage the max was about 200, maybe.
Same exactly. I won the Nationals at 186. I was like,
yeah. Wow, really?
What the hell, yeah.
Wow. But I look back at the picture, go, man, I look pretty freaking huge in the picture, but I didn't weigh much.
Yeah,
the bone structure was so incredible.
I used to go to a chiropractor, and the guy would adjust me, and he goes, holy shit, you got a really small frame under all this muscle. I couldn't believe it. What the hell? How did you pack on so much muscle in a tiny little frame? Oh, getting back to the tuna fish, I had tuna fish and coffee. You know, my good friend Kent King threw me out of the gym one day. Go Santa Monica. That's what I was eating every day. Tuna out of the can and coffee. Get out of here, smelling up the gym.
The gym smelled bad enough as it was.
Right.
As that tuna, man.
Coffee smells, yes, and coffee. I didn't have any money. I was trying to survive, you know.
Hey, I want to ask you guys, when you finally made it to the pro stage, and you know, because nowadays they give out pro card again, complaining about today's days, but they give out pro cards so easily, but it was hard to get a pro card back in the 70s and 80s. So when you finally got that pro card, what was that like?
Oh. Well, I went to I was suspended from IVB.
You had a difficult time, Tony. You weren't welcome with open arms, right, to the IVB?
Not at all. So I was starving, and this guy from Rhode Island calls me up. He says, "Hey, I want you to guest pose." I was always in shape because, you know, that's who I was.
Yeah.
So, okay, in a couple of weeks I'll be ready. So I go to Rhode Island, I guest pose at the show, and I come off stage, and this kid run backstage. He goes, "Man, you're in crazy shape. You should go to New York next week and compete for Mr. World."
Mm.
I go, "Okay, I'll drive you." So he drives me to New York. I'll never forget that drive because I almost died in the car. I mean, it's New York driving. Come on, just crazy.
I'm familiar.
But he got me there. So I win Mr. World, you know, WBBG, Dan Lorries.
Was this after the America, Tony?
Yep. This is way after America. 71. This is late 79 now.
Okay.
Like I said, I'm really starving. I won America 78, September to like October 79. I was just sleeping on my friend's sofa.
Wow.
In his mom's house in the hood. Yeah, that's where I kind of ended up. I mean, really nothing was happening to this phone call. There's a few bucks to be made. So I guess pose. The guy drives me to New York, and I won the World Wobble. I mean,
WBBG.
Lawrence, yes. And then, but you get a free pass to go to London if you win. So that's how I turned pro. That was my pro show, the first one.
Because after you won the America, Tom Platz beat you for that American team. So then he won the IFBB Universe. So what was your plan after that America, Tony? After that happened.
I didn't have a plan. Like I said, I never had a plan.
But the only thing you could do was go back the next year, right, and try and get on the team. Isn't that what you had to do?
Yes, but I got suspended. Way then.
Oh, you did.
What happened was I was starving, and then I was sleeping behind a church, and this guy, you know, says, "Hey, my friends in South America want you to guest pose down there." And I go, "Okay." Down in Belize. So I fly down there. I get to the hotel, and this is in the book, of course, and the guy at the desk says, "Hey, here's a telegram." Back in those days, there's telegrams. So I open the telegram. It's a letter from Ben Weider. And he goes, "If you post tomorrow, you're going to get a life suspension."
Jeez.
That's was it a non-IFBB sanctioned show, Tony?
Yes, that's right. And the guy, the promoter told me, he says, not sanctioned IFBB. Would you do it? I'm starving, man. I need money. I got to eat. So I go on stage, and there is a life suspension now. So that's how it all. So, yeah, I turned pro at that show in New York. Now I'm suspended. Can't guest pose anywhere IFBB or at seminars or anything.
Yeah.
So I went to London, and I got second to Enlulu from Turkey.
Yeah.
Universe.
Yeah.
79, yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember seeing pictures of that.
But then I look back and I go, he's been there many years before, and it was my first time there. So
yeah,
I think his time was he was you know, was up. You know what I mean? Even though we had a tremendous crazy pose down with toe to toe, crazy. But I go, you know, okay, you got it, all right. So, but then a year later, so now I'm pro, And a year later, I'm in Paris, and I was in Germany. And then Newbery said to me, he says, you know, you're already in Europe, and you're in great shape. Why don't you go back to London and try to pull it off again? So I won the Pro Universe.
Okay.
But to get the Pro card, I mean, it was a lot of work. But I had a lot of obstacles in my way. It wasn't just, you know, mm-hmm. I didn't have any contracts. There's no endorsements. The phone didn't ring.
Yeah.
Nothing. I went homeless again. I won Mr. America and I was homeless.
Yeah. That's unbelievable. That's not surprising, but amazing.
Yeah.
That can happen to anybody.
People don't know that. I was actually starving again. And then, I mean, but the letdown, because I said to myself, I win Mr. America, man, I made it. I got to have the contract, this and that.
Yeah.
I got zero. And I can never explain it. I cannot figure it out. Even today, I cannot figure it out. Even though they said I should not have won, but I still won. Just because you're the champ, you still should get, There's a lot of shows people say you shouldn't have won.
Right.
You got lucky or,
always.
Yeah. It's always like that.
They blamed you for winning the show.
Yes, they blamed me. I got all.
You had nothing to do with it.
Right. I got the rap for it.
Right.
And then I was punished throughout all my shows in IVB ever since that.
Jeez, unbelievable. So when did you go over to the IVB? 83, like?
No. I wrote a letter. So that was 78. So 81, I wrote a letter to Ben.
Okay.
Because my friend, Kit Keene, good friend of mine. He said, you need to write a letter to Ben. I was hanging out in L.A. doing a la-la-la, doing the L.A. thing. I was young and crazy. I go, really? Okay. So I wrote two lines to Ben. I apologize. And then he sent me a letter back, and he said, it's okay. You're reinstated.
Yes. Wow, just from a letter. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I'm back. But there was a catch to this letter, though. I didn't realize. So I'm back in IVB, and Arnold, I saw him in the Rose Cafe, and he said to me, why don't you go to Australia, Mr. Universe, IVB, first show for me. I'm excited. Go down there and win something for a change. So I fly out. I go to Australia, backstage, pumping up, feeling good. And then someone came over to me and he said, you're never going to win. Just like that. You'll always place top five, always make money, but you're never going to win.
Hmm.
And he walked away. So this is just before I go on stage. Imagine what that's doing to your head.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So there's only one picture that I've seen from that show where I'm looking up to God going, why? There's a picture, and I'm looking to heaven. So I come third. And it proved true. So I look back on my career now and I go, he was right.
Didn't you win one, though, Tony, in Portland or something?
One.
Yeah.
Denver.
Denver, okay. Yeah.
Remember those Grand Prix shows?
Yeah.
Denver in 83, 80, and then 1 week later I'm in Portland, Oregon, and guess who showed up?
Oh,
Joe Weider comes backstage, looks at me. You really want to win, huh? Zach works. I'm young. I'm pumping up, getting ready to go on stage. You know how your mind says you got to go on stage. And I go, yeah, Joe, of course I want to win. I was really, really in shape. This is 83, 84.
Yeah.
I'm diehard shape. And I go, of course I want to win. I'm intense. I came second.
Oh.
So, yeah. This is facts. And then I go, okay, Australia, he was right. And so the rest of the time, I knew what was going to happen before I even show up. But I make sure I was in 100% conditioning because that got me seminars that would give me guest posing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was using the Michael Jackson thing. So I said, just show up in shape. Do your best, no matter what. Keep smiling. And then the phone's going to ring. Get some guest posing out of it. And most of the promoters that shows, all those shows, they always invited me because they know I'm going to pose. Mm-hmm. And they know I'm in shape.
Right.
So that's how it all played out. Yes, I got reinstated, but there were strings attached.
Yeah. What about you, Tom, when you turned pro?
Well, it's interesting because I had a similar story the year before at the Nationals at the I think it was Phil. It was you that won the light heavy overall. And I was second, and I think was it Moses Maldonado that was third?
No, it was J.J. Marsh.
J.J. Where did Moses place in that? Was he fourth?
He placed fourth. He was fourth.
Fourth. And so that year, I remember, and I was feeling good. You know, you and I, you remember the experience. It was like they called us out, comparisons, and never called us out again.
Never called us back.
It was the most unusual prejudging I've ever experienced or have ever seen, you know?
Yeah.
And so I felt really good going into the night show. Of course, I had everybody say, hey, Phil looks great. It's going to be a battle. And I wanted that battle. You know what I mean? Yeah. And then Moses, as I'm pumping up, getting ready to go out to my routine, that night show, Moses come up. He says, man, you look really good. Congratulations. I just got the word from the judges. You're second. I had to write that. Literally, I said to myself, you son of a bitch. That is not freaking cool at all, right? So anyway, that was my experience that year, and Phil took it, and he justified and deserved it without question. So the next year, and I had momentum because I was third in the light heavies, then second to Phil, and next year won the light heavyweight division, earning the pro card. And so it was, you know, and I knew going into that third national championship that this is it. I've got the momentum. If I backslide now, it's going to be impossible to pull myself out of it. So I had to go there in great shape. I had to be ready. And I knew, and it was interesting because that was the year. And again, you know, as Tony was talking about, we've all got these demons. We've all got this past and we've all got these struggles internally. And it was like, as I was approaching this idea that I'm going to be a champion, this is going to be my year. This is the one. There was also something else going on below the surface on an unconscious level that was telling me, you're not a champion. You're not good. You're one of the one percenters. You're not really part of all that. You can't be a champion. You'll never be good enough for that. Right? So I had this internal battle going on with myself. And I had mentioned my early mentor from when I was a teenager at Future Man Gym, Tony Pandolfo. And I had great training partners leading up to this all these years. You don't get that far without really good people pushing and shoving and encouraging you along the way. And making you do those extra reps that you don't really want to do. But I called Tony out of the blue like 2 months before because I couldn't get my head into it. And, you know, you got to be training. It's a minimum 12 weeks to prepare. You know what I mean? And I'm now like 8 weeks out and I'm not ready. And it's not happening. I couldn't get my head into it. I called Tony. And so I get him on the phone. I said, Tony, you know my situation. It's third, second. The momentum's with me this year. I can make it happen, but I can't get my head. He said, don't say another word. He said, be in the gym tomorrow at 6 a.m. And sure enough, for the next 8 weeks, we trained together and he just freaking annihilated me. I mean, I've never trained so hard, so intense and so focused. He demanded my head be there. I had no choice.
Yeah.
To be there. You know what I mean? And it really taught me a powerful lesson. At that point, I was ready to win. I was ready to turn pro. And it was because of that experience, because of the overcoming that fear, that doubt, that uncertainty, that the past that was I was dragging from the past with me, that I was able to do that and ultimately win that pro card. But I'll tell you what, it was an elating moment, especially going up against the competition. I had Mike Ashley, who was brilliant. What a great physique. And J.J. Marsh, of course, and some of the other guys. I mean, it was just an incredible competition. So to be able to do that night. And of course, I was more than happy to not win the overall to the incredible Gary Stridham, who just looked brilliant that night himself and was in great shape. But it was an experience. And then, of course, after turning pro, you know, we kind of, like Tony, it's just like we kind of have these expectations that all this stuff, it's all going to happen now.
Yeah, right.
It's all coming on my way. You know what I mean? It's just like,
I've made it.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, we wasn't giving out contracts to people left and right.
Right. There's no money.
No. I always had great posing routines. So like Tony, I got invited to do a lot of guest posings, which kept me in fairly good shape. Probably also kept me from getting a little thicker and a little bigger over the course of the next year. My first pro show was Night of the Champions in 87, I think it was 87. And I think I took sixth that year. And I was disappointed because it was in Night of the Champions. I'd been to Night of the Champions several times as spectator. Mm-hmm. It's my home turf. You know what I mean? It's New York. And talk about entourage. I mean, I had already built two gyms. I had two big gyms back in Long Island. They were successful. So we had all this like entourage. Like half the audience was there to kind of like encourage me. And then I got beat. And it's like, hey, what are you going to do, man? But
hey, Tom, let me ask you a question. Why did you have that doubt 8 weeks out from the Nationals? Was it just the pressure, you think?
No, I think it was because there was something else going on below the surface that was telling me, as I got closer to being a champion, to winning the goal that I had for the last 4 years,
yeah,
as I was getting closer to that, there was something else going on below the surface that was saying, you're not good enough for that. You'll never be that guy, whoever I put up on the pedestal as Mr. America, National Bodybuilding Champion, Mr. Olympia, whoever those guys were that I had up on the pedestal at the time,
yeah.
You'll never be that guy. You're not good enough for that. And it wasn't about me not being good enough physique-wise. It was just me not being good enough, period. Mm. Not having, you know, whether it was earning the stripes or not, it was all. And a lot of that comes from, like Tony, having a sordid, you know, childhood, growing up with some discouragement and some frustrations and doubts. And you know my story, turning those doubts, fears, and uncertainties into, you know, a short-lived career as an outlaw biker. Mm-hmm. That was the manifestation of it. And then ultimately breaking free of that. And then it starts to show up. Those things, as Tony said, we carry those things. Life, they're with us forever.
They don't go away.
Visit your hometown. Visit your old school. Visit whatever those experiences were. They come up.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and we may have suppressed them a little bit. I call it the dragon. We can push the dragon back into its dark lair. But at those given moments, they'll show up. And for me, it was showing up about 8 weeks. It showed up before that, which is why it took 4 or 5 weeks for me to realize, holy shit, I can't get on track here.
Yeah.
Something's not right. So I finally realized that. And I think an important lesson for me was, and I wrote about this in 7 Rules of Achievement, is know what your resources are and have the ability to be able to reach out to those resources, the humility to reach out for those resources when they're there. And reaching out to Tony Pandolfo was the greatest resource I ever exercised in my life. It was the savior, you know? So that's my story about turning pro. But it was, man, after all those years of trying, you know what I mean? And like, boom, this is it?
Yeah.
It was fantastic. It was a great.
All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And thank you to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to all you generous Patreon donors who always support the show each week. And I try to give back to you guys by sending you out little excerpts of my interviews that are not broadcast on the air. So you're getting a little something extra that no one else is getting. If you're interested in becoming a Patreon donor, you can just go to our official website, which is bodybuildinglegendshow.com. And in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the link to become a Patreon donor. And I appreciate all you guys for doing that. All right, so I want to get to this article, which comes from the February 1979 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. It's called The Unhappiest Mr. America, written by, of course, the great Rick Wayne. And it is about Tony Pearson when he won the Mr. America title. I thought it would fit in with this interview since Tony talked a lot about his career on part one of our interview. It says he dreamed of bodybuilding honors. He could hardly wait to come to California to train among the superstars. Little did he know that achievement of his big dream would make him the unhappiest Mr. America. It had been one of those particularly hectic days at the Weider office in Woodland Hills. Publisher Joe Weider was climbing the varnished walls over the nightmarish remote possibility that Muscle Builder would be a couple days late getting to the printers. For Joe, such a thing is tantamount to sacrilege and blasphemy and murder all rolled into one. And those responsible, never the master blaster, you understand, deserve a fate worse than death. So the Muscle Builder staff was under siege. Of all times for Tony Pearson to come calling on me, he said he had been sent by Arnold Schwarzenegger, something to do with an article for Muscle Builder. Are you a writer? I asked, somewhat offhandedly. You don't understand, he said, pleasantly. I'm not a writer, just a bodybuilder who's going to be Mr. America one day. He smiled as he said that, which did very little to dull the serrated edge of what I assumed at the time was a mindless boast on his part. Somehow you knew he wasn't just talking, however. He meant every bragging word. I did not take him seriously. I mean, there was nothing about this person that even vaguely suggested bodybuilding honors. He seemed hardly different from the scores of overambitious people who find their way to the Weider building in search of fame and fortune,
some offering unsolicited endorsements for pay, others seeking sponsorship, and a future like Arnold or Franco. So I said, as nicely as I could, under the somewhat pressing circumstances, Joe was calling us all kinds of unkind names over the business of the late muscle builder, I really don't have time to interview at this moment, maybe later, which, let's face it, was the diplomat's way of saying, buzz off out of my hair. I did not tell Pearson what I was really thinking, that he had been the victim of yet another Arnold Schwarzenegger unfunny practical joke. You know how famous he is for that. And that he was hardly ready for an in-depth muscle builder interview. Naturally, he left, obviously disappointed, but he took it well. I mean, he didn't threaten to blow up the building in the night or even lay some scratches on anyone's car or anything like that. And, of course, I promptly forgot about him. But one day later, Arnold Schwarzenegger was on the phone. Ricky, this is Arnold. Why didn't you interview Tony Pearson? Who? Pearson, Tony Pearson. He's the black guy I sent over yesterday. He's going to be great. Come on, Arnold, I interrupted. Who are you kidding? I'm serious. I saw the guy with his shirt off, and I promise you, he's going to be great. You really ought to do a story about him and be the first. Arnold actually believed what he was saying. And now I recalled how a British record company had turned down the Beatles back in the 60s. A producer had told Brian Epstein on hearing a demo record by the then largely known rock group that there was nothing worth bothering about in John, Paul, George, and Ringo. They made an awful noise, he said, as Epstein walked out the door. But hardly 2 weeks later, that producer was looking for a job in the construction business, now that the Fab Four were sitting pretty at the top of everyone's hit parade and well on their way to establishing their incredible legend. How could I have been that wrong? Still, I did nothing to undo what damage I might have done in my reputation as a spotter of bodybuilding talent. The next time I laid eyes on Tony Pearson, he was sitting in an office adjoining mine, talking into Jack Neary's tape recorder. If my memory serves well, I believe Jack's story actually appeared in Muscle Builder. The months rolled on, and Pearson had quit training at that place on Venice Beach where all the strange folk work out in the sun. It seems he had a talk with Schwarzenegger and taken his advice. Pearson had taken to training at Gold's Gym in the company of Robbie Robinson, Manuel Perry, Bill Grant, Larry Jackson, and so on. Indeed, he and Robinson had been partners for a time. Moreover, Pearson was definitely beginning to look like Mr. Material, shaping up like a champion, that is. He was not massive, not in the Robinson or Perry fashion, you understand, but then neither could he be mistaken for Sammy Davis or J.J. Walker. Even in his sweat-soaked training shirt and gym pants, he was particularly impressive. No mean feat when you consider the regular clientele at Gold's. Suddenly, the line that I had taken as an idle boast some months earlier was sounding like, in my head, more like a serious promise. The new Pearson had acquired not only more muscle size, but was ripped and symmetrical. He trained like a man with a mission. He attacked his various body parts as if his time were running out, and what had to be achieved in a big hurry. Whether he was bench pressing, performing abdominal crunches, or toe raises on the calf machine, determination accompanied his every move. Not once did he and Robbie Robinson exchange a word. They seemed to function in a set of prearranged signals. He knew exactly when his partner needed a helpful finger, gritted his teeth to blast weights to arm's length overhead, casually accepted Robbie's slave-driving vibrations. They took an interesting workout, to say the least, these two. Then on Memorial Day, I spied Tony Pearson among the sweating, hip-swinging, shoving, agitated crowd that had poured in from all over Los Angeles to witness the bizarre annual ritual that the city council promotes at Venice Beach under the guise of a physique contest. No, Pearson was not entered in the Mr. Venice Beach or whatever event, but he was called at one point in the weird proceedings to come up on the concrete structure that served as a stage. He stood there smiling in huge and cut-off jeans and tank top, waved massive and muscular arms at the cheering audience, and then jumped off the platform, but not before I had taken a really good look at the improvements he continued to make. His thighs looked like they must have measured at least 26 inches in circumference. He looked like he could have weighed 190 pounds, and yet he was not nearly fat. In truth, by the lumps which showed through his shirt, it was clear that his abdominals and intercostals were in fine form, evidence enough that the kid was ripped, as they say. I could hardly wait for an opportunity to stick my tape recorder under Tony Pearson's nose. How right Arnold had been about him. I got my chance 2 days before the 1978 AAU Mr. America contest. Tony had come to visit. something to do with a photo session for the Master Blaster. Only Joe was somewhat tied up at the time. How do you think it's going to go at the A, I asked Pearson, who by this time was already Junior Mr. America and Mr. USA, too. It's actually Junior Mr. USA. He shrugged his shoulders, smiled confidently. I can't say for certain, he said, but I think I'm ready. Ready to take on Tufel? Ron Tufel had only days earlier impressed a bad and blasé crowd at Sprague's World Cup event in Los Angeles. Pearson seemed unsure what to say to that, so he remained silent. Do you think you can take the Mr. America title? I persisted. No, he replied. I'm not thinking this year will be my Mr. America year. I'll be more than happy if I get my class trophy. He said that he'd spent much time on his thighs and calves, and under non-stopping prodding from some unnamed fellow who had accompanied him to the Weider building, Pearson consented to show me the improvement. As he dropped his pants in my office, I prayed one of the female staff members would not at that particular moment find just cause to call on me. The thighs were still huge and defined, with little veins crisscrossing them. Very impressive. Go on, Tony, show him the calves, man, said the companion. Pearson shifted his body to show me his right calf from the right side. It was reasonable, if not riotous. Then he angled his lower leg so that I could view the muscle from the meatier side. Hey, it wasn't meant, sir, but then neither was it something chickens could crow over. It seemed to me that Pearson was equipped to hold his own, especially when the companion had actually talked him into opening up his shirt to display his amazing abdominals. Before our interview was over, Pearson told me how he always dreamed of bodybuilding honors, how Muscle Builder had inspired him as a kid back in St. Louis, Missouri. I could hardly wait to leave high school and head for California. I read so much about the super champs who trained at Gold's. I knew the only way to achieve my bodybuilding dreams was to head for that gym. The line triggered another thought in my mind. Is it true that guys come from all over the states to train at Gold's because they believe it's the only way to win the top titles? He answered so quickly I knew he had not caught the full meaning behind my question. Yes, it's true, Pearson said. The gym is so famous, we see all the latest equipment displayed in the Muscle Builder pictures taken at Gold's. Hell, we figure that it's the only place to train if you want to be Mr. America. This is not what I meant, I said. The fact is that many bodybuilders come to Gold's on the assumption that since Ken Sprague, the owner of the gym, is also secretary of the AAU Physique Committee, he'll arrange it so that one of his members makes out. They come out there shortly before the Mr. America contest thinking it's the only way they'll have a chance in the contest. Now he got the point. He looked down at his feet, shifted in his chair, looked over at the companion. I don't believe that, he said finally. I think a guy can do a lot for himself training in the environment at Gold's, training next to Robbie and the other stars. But in the end, you have to stand up on your own 2 feet and make it on your own. And you still don't think that this is your year for taking the Mr. America title? Not this year, said Pearson seriously. Tony Pearson was wrong. He did not make the USA team that was chosen on the night of the Mr. America event to compete in the Mr. Universe in Acapulco. But he certainly took the Mr. America title, to everyone's surprise, to say the least. Indeed, no other Mr. America contest has spawned as much controversy as the one held in September 1978. The letters poured into our office, all criticizing the event, most of them declaring clearly that Tony Pearson was not good enough even to have placed fourth. We received phone calls supporting the sentiment. One AAU official wrote something about that was definitely wrong in the AAU's Denmark of bodybuilding. He suggested the whole contest had been fixed, and worse. Tony Pearson came home as Mr. America. He had achieved his big dream, but not for one moment had he anticipated the North Pole winds that greeted him in Santa Monica. Pearson's a very quiet man. You have to pull words out of his belly. The attitude to his victory did not change him. He still is quietly going about his business. He has appeared with Ken Sprague on the Merv Griffin Show and Good Morning America, but now the fire in his eyes has been replaced by a cloud of sadness. Pearson is not the happy person he used to be. He cannot understand why many of his peers have sent him to Coventry, why they won't talk to him, why he's being made to pay for what they think was a fixed decision. For, in fact, the result of the Mr. America was prearranged. Tony Pearson knows nothing about that arrangement. As I say, he had not planned on being Mr. America in 1978. It turned out that way. He was judged, rightly or wrongly, the winner. As far as he knows, he won fairly. Indeed, there was much controversy when Arnold first beat Oliva in Columbus, Ohio. There was talk of a fix, but no one chose to ostracize the Austrian. When Cal Scalak took the Mr. Universe award over a disappointed Mike Mentzer, there was talk of something cockeyed having transpired, but Cal received deserved respect from his peers. It's one thing feeling disappointment with a judging panel and quite another to take it out on the man adjudged the winner. Tony Pearson is not the worst Mr. America in the history of the event. He trains hard and consistently. He goes through the rigors of competitive bodybuilding, just like you and me and your bodybuilding cousins. It's wrong that he should be treated in the fashion currently accorded him. If there was a fault in the Mr. America setup, then it seems to me that someone other than Pearson ought to be on the carpet. That someone should be pointed out and ostracized, not Tony Pearson. Meanwhile, Tony goes about the business of preparing for his next bodybuilding mountain. He has his eyes set on the Mr. Universe title. We at Muscle Builder wish him good luck before, during, and after the contest. All right. Good article by Rick Wayne. And, of course, Tony talked about that same thing in the interview we just heard. And, of course, Tony had a rough time as a pro bodybuilder, but he did persist. And he does remain now today a true bodybuilding legend, someone who really made his mark in the bodybuilding world in his posing routines. And then he had a lot of victories in those mixed pairs contests that were really popular in the 80s. So Tony persisted. He loved bodybuilding, and he became a great champion. So good for him. All right, guys, that's it for our show. Next week, we will have part two of our interview with Tom Terwilliger, Tony Pearson, and Phil Williams. I hope you guys can make it back. Until then, stay healthy out there. Stay away from that COVID. Keep training hard, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.